From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. There are 16 teams left in the world's biggest sporting event. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at Stage 2 of the World Cup and a chronicle of all the first-round fun had by supporters of Team Germany. Also, your letters and a conversation with editor David Remnick about a new collection of The New Yorker's best sports writing. Also, meet the man who may make Wimbledon as synonymous with poetry as it is with strawberries and cream.
Thwack, 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 plock, thwackety flick, thwackety flack, twoity, froity, froity, twoity, slowity, quickity, quickity, slowity, turnity, headity, headity, turnity. Out! Game. New balls, please.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The second round of games at the World Cup in South Africa will lack the defending champions, Italy, who finished at the bottom of their group. The French, runners-up 4 years ago, have also gone home after what the Minister of Sports there has called a moral disaster. But Landon Donovan's extra-time goal against Algeria on Wednesday catapulted the U.S. to the top of their group, thereby earning Donovan Dempsey et al. The right to play Ghana this afternoon. Joining me now from South Africa to discuss this and other World Cup matters is Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall. Grant, Ghana beat the U.S. 4 years ago in a first-round World Cup match. How likely is a different result today?
The U.S. feels like they can beat them. If you look at the FIFA rankings, in fact, the U.S. is quite a ways ahead of Ghana. And I think this U.S. team feels like things have gone very well to this point. It hasn't always been easy, but they won the group ahead of England and come in here on a high.
England will play Germany tomorrow in a matchup English fans will certainly relish as long as their team wins. Germany has looked the better of the two in the early going, but is this the day celebrated Manchester United striker Wayne Rooney steps up for England?
Well, if he does, it would be about time because Rooney is yet to score in this tournament. And I think he's been really frustrated for most of the first three games that England has played, the first two of which were ugly ties against the United States and Algeria. If England's going to have any chance of making a run deep into this World Cup, as most of us thought they would, Rooney really does need to get on track starting now.
Is security a particular concern for England v. Germany? I understand it's been stepped up.
Most of the fans here, the hardcore fans, are very friendly, I found, over the years. But the English fans do have a bit of a reputation of being sort of nasty sometimes. And because of the long rivalry between England and Germany that goes back to world wars and all sorts of things, sometimes you see some bad behavior between the two sides.
There was a very public dispute between the French coach and his players. Was that enough to explain France's failure, or was there more to it?
France just let a couple bad things happen, and it really spiraled out of control into a meltdown pretty quickly. Not a lot of leadership on that team. Any team that refuses to practice and essentially goes on strike during a World Cup, you have to question their professionalism. They had a coach, Ray Domenech, who was just terrible over the last few years for France. I call him Crazy Ray, and thankfully for France, he won't be around any longer.
Grant, when France returned home, the president of the country summoned Thierry Henry and treated this whole thing as kind of an international incident. Has it been seen that way in South Africa as well?
Well, I think there's a bit of schadenfreude, actually, among people who may not be huge fans of France or think that the players got what they deserved. I don't know how seriously everyone thinks it should be for the president of France to intervene, but that's what happens at the World Cup. These games reflect national pride, whether it's Bill Clinton telling that to the U.S. players or Nicolas Sarkozy feeling like the French team didn't have that.
Spain had to get a result, as they say, to avoid the possibility of joining Italy and France on the outside looking in. They ended up beating Chile 2-1 to finish atop the group and avoid having to play Brazil next. They get Portugal instead. Is the Spanish team a threat going forward?
Well, once you get to the knockout round, what you did in the first round doesn't really matter anymore. And Spain did lose their first game to Switzerland in this tournament, but that's the way it works. You can lose a game and come back. And I really feel good about Spain's chances, actually. I picked them to win this tournament before it started. They're the best team here in my mind and one of the most entertaining teams.
Grant, Brazil didn't need to beat Portugal to go through, so they didn't. That game ended in a 0-0 tie. To what extent does this edition of the Brazilian side resemble some of that country's great World Cup winners?
Well, I was down in Brazil about a month and a half ago, and it was fascinating to me that even though Brazil was in a position to be favored to win the World Cup, a lot of their fans were really disappointed with the coach, Dunga, and the way his team plays, that it's not about the beautiful game anymore with this team, that it's more about power and speed. And this Brazil team, I think, is feared, but it's not loved like previous Brazil teams, both inside Brazil and around the world. And they may well win the World Cup, but Brazilian fans are pretty spoiled, and they want not just to win, but to win with style.
Are South Africans still excited about the World Cup, despite the fact that the home team didn't go through?
South Africans really are excited about the World Cup still, which is a good thing. Obviously, people here were really fired up for their own team. And I think there's a pride now that the South African team went out on a victory against France. So they can have their heads held high, and they've run a good World Cup to this point. There haven't been any major incidents that were feared beforehand. And it's been a good environment for the World Cup. It's not like Germany, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
Among the Africans attending the World Cup, has there been a great run on Ghana shirts because of the way we've seen Ghana go through and nobody else from Africa go through?
Yeah, it's honestly a disappointment that only one African team out of the six here got to the final 16. Everyone wondered if in the first World Cup on African soil that an African team might challenge even to win it. Unless Ghana makes a surprise run, that's not going to happen. So I do think now that Ghana is the only African team in the tournament that Africans will back that one remaining continental team, and including South Africans.
Okay, Grant, with only 16 teams remaining in play, it should be much easier than it was at the start of the tournament for you to pick a winner. Who do you like?
I like Spain. They're a team that I picked to win this thing at the start. I don't think we've seen Spain's best soccer yet, but just because you're not playing in the most entertaining fashion doesn't mean you're not going to win games. Italy's proved that over the years, and I think this Spain team's going to heat up and go through the elimination rounds and raise the trophy.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he joins me from time to time on Only a Game to talk about it as well. Thank you, Grant.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, traditional powerhouse Germany will take on arch rival England to determine which will advance to the quarterfinal stage. Only a Game's Kurt Nickisch attended viewing parties for each of Germany's group stage games, and he has this story of the team's cool and confident supporters.
The Goethe Institute in Boston is usually home to German language classes, wine tastings, and book readings. But this month, that other cultural phenomenon, Fußball, is front and center.
So we're showing all the games as long as Germany is in the World Cup. So we'll be showing lots of games.
More than 120 people pack the Institute's largest room as Germany kicks off its first round-robin game against Australia. The price of entry, $10, but that also gets you a couple of coupons for beer and Bavarian pretzels. The napkins are in the German national colors, and a bust of Goethe in black, red, and gold looks on as a relentless German attack shell-shocks Australian defenders. Germany is off to a 4-0 drubbing. The mood here is reminiscent of the last World Cup when host Germany made an inspiring run to the semis. Andreas Hilfinger, a German researcher working in Boston, revels again in that shared national joy in this civilized setting.
If you go to a bar, you always get a lot of drunken thugs. It doesn't seem to be the case here. So you just have a lot of people and everyone's excited. And so that's kind of great. That's how I like it. I mean, it's like having people over in your living room to watch it. It's much more exciting than by yourself, but then you don't have random idiots throwing beers around and stuff like that.
Another reason for the joy is the uncertainty that surrounded the German team heading into the Cup. Their experienced captain, Michael Ballack, is off the roster with an injury, and this team is the youngest German team in the tournament's 80-year history. But those worries fade as four different players score in this first game. Hidefumi Tamita looks happy.
So you're Japanese, and you are wearing a Germany jersey. So explain how this all comes together.
I really like the German people. I personally feel a lot of similarities in Germany and Japan.
Tomita says Germany has done a better job than his country of dealing with its past. And so he feels like German fans now can show their national pride without looking down on other countries.
Yeah, I really envy this sort of, I don't know how to call this, but I think this is amazing.
But that amazing feeling dissipates during the next group game. The Goethe Institute shows last week's battle against defensive-minded Serbia on Tetzele, so fans can watch the German language broadcast.
Nee! Oh, nee! Gelbrot! Nee!
Disaster strikes when Germany's experienced forward Miroslav Klose trips a Serb player from behind and gets ejected with a second yellow card. Less than 2 minutes later, Serbia scores on a defensive mistake.
Achtung! Achtung! Und es passiert eine Minute nach der Rausstellung von Klose.
Germany loses 1-0. Suddenly, advancing out of the group is in doubt. It all comes down to the final game against Ghana. Workday hours keep numbers down. Only 50 people show up for Germany's crucial match against an athletic Ghana team. At halftime, it's scoreless. Jinya Oh wrapped a German flag around her waist to help cheer on her team.
Obviously, it's not okay if they don't make it. And I don't care who is the better team. I'm so sure that they will move on. I can't imagine them not moving on.
Maybe it's the fact that Deutschland has never in any World Cup failed to advance out of group play. So when Mesut Özil threads the needle with a shot from distance, no one throws beer bottles. They celebrate like they've been here before. The goal lifts Germany to first place in its group and guarantees a round of 16 match against England. Goethe Institute employee Karin Erlenschläger is already stressing out.
Sunday morning. Oh, we'll knock the British out. So that's the thing. Are we going to serve beer Sunday morning or not?
The game, that'll sort itself out. But how to get organized for the next viewing party, well, that's another matter. For Only a Game, I'm Kurt Nikisch.
To view Kurt Nikisch's Goethe Institute photos, please visit onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. If, like Colin Carroll, you regard the Olympic movement as a fossil, perhaps you'll become a fan of the Paddy Games. Carroll, who has made something of a name for himself as an elephant polo player, says the 2012 Paddy Games will be comprised of 25 sports, including backwards and blindfolded sprints, mobile phone throwing, and an interspecies relay race, which will require two humans to team with two other animals. Carroll is trying to convince 100-meter champion Usain Bolt to compete in the backward sprint, but acknowledges that the Olympic champion has given him no firm response. Carroll claims his games will occur in 2012 London, simultaneously with the other Olympics, whether they like it or not. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Venus and Serena 2.0. But first, how could Wimbledon, the world's most prestigious tennis tournament, get any tonier? Simple, toss in a poet. That would be Matt Harvey, the tournament's official championships poet, who joins me now from London. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Mr. Harvey, you're the championship's poet. Should I address you as your poetship, or perhaps my lord the monger of verse?
You can feel free. I'll answer to pretty much most things that people say to me, but if you just stick with Matt for now, partly just to save time.
I'll do it then. Matt, are there any perks? Do you get robes or a scepter or perhaps a special hat?
You know what? I don't need robes. I don't need a scepter or a special hat. What I have is a very special laminated badge that gets me access pretty much all areas. People would die for this badge.
Yes.
So I can go anywhere except the players' dressing rooms. What it doesn't do, this is tragic, it doesn't get me just free access to centre court or the show courts whenever I would like. And that's because Wimbledon are saying to me, look, could you focus more on the background and the umpires and the ball boys and the queue and the strawberries and the Boston Ivy clambering up the side of the buildings? You're not a sports poet, Matt. They say you're not a sports journalist, poet. So I'm here to really write about the setting. And having said that, people are saying, hey, what an amazing match, isn't there? And Mahou, what are you going to do, Matt? What are you going to do?
Well, the question on that one is, are you going to write a really long poem to commemorate that match?
What I decided to do when I woke up this morning was to celebrate with a haiku. I think the longest game in history needs to be celebrated with the shortest verse form. I actually did write before it finished. I wrote the Isner Mahou haiku.
Well, perhaps we should hear it.
Well, perhaps we should. I shall immediately find it. I just having brought it up, I should at least read it. I think it goes, high performance play all day and yet no climax. It's tantric tennis.
I was anticipating one that would perhaps say all day, all day, all day. Just go on.
it took a detour at that point. It should have done.
We should give our listeners an idea of your versatility, because the haiku is hardly all that you've mastered. Perhaps you could read at least the first 14 lines of the poem titled Thwack.
Could I be perverse and read the last 14 lines?
You're the poet.
You know, this is a whole game. It's a whole game of tennis from level to game. We join it at 40-30. Bounce, 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 bounce. Thwack, 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 plock, thwackety-plick, thwackety-plack, two-ity-fro-ity-fro-ity-two-ity, slowity-quickety-quickety-slowity, turnity-headity-headity-turnity. Seems like we've been here a blimmin' eternity, righty-lefty-lefty-righty, toppity-spinity, backhandy-slicity, lookity-watchity-scratchity-bottity, fabulous forehand, backhandy-slicity, furious forehand, savagely-slicity, fearsome ferocity, vicious velocity, bilious backhand, blasted so blistery, half a mile out with that line judge's history. Out! Game. New balls, please.
Wonderful. It's just breathtaking.
You know what people say? It's a little bit of fun for the kids. You look at those lines, eternity, headity, headity, eternity. Seems like we've been here a blooming eternity. I think they're prophetic lines.
Well, do you suppose that one of these lines will one day be carved into a gate at Wimbledon? Are we talking about eternity here?
I think there's every possibility. Maybe it's just me offered a fantasy trip. I don't know. It's hard to tell. I like to think some kind of brass plaque, maybe inlaid, perhaps along St. Mary's Walk or the foot of Henman Hill. Just thwack, plock, plick.
It's evident that you've had no fun with this difficult task at all.
Well, you know, I think there was a certain amount of permission. They said to me at the beginning, Matt, you've got absolute carte blanche here, but just please don't embarrass us. And okay, you know, I'm willing just to tread a fine line, but it's something that I'm willing to do out of my sense of duty.
How very British of you.
Yes, I'm feeling it. As the days go by, I feel increasingly British, actually. I'm actually English, and, of course, the English are British. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting area, the whole British. I'd like to read you my Andy Murray poem.
Well, I was going to say, there is another poem that I'd like you to read that rather addresses that situation called One of Ours.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I'll read you One of Ours. If ever he's brattish or brutish or skittish, he's Scottish. But if he looks fittish and his form is hottish, he's British.
That poem is referring to Andy Murray. Obviously, each time Wimbledon comes along, the English hope for somebody from England to win the men's side, the women's side, or both sides. Are you rooting for Murray?
I am, as it happens, yeah. I don't have many other people to root for, to be honest. And so, but I do like the guy, and I feel like, even though I don't really know him, I feel like I've got to know him. I've sort of watched him mature as a player and as a man, and so I would really like him to do very, very well and go all the way here. That would give me enormous pleasure, even though it would put great pressure on me to write perhaps a more solemn poem to celebrate it. But I'd be willing to make the effort.
Well, I can see as you might root for Andy Murray, because nothing rhymes with Federer.
in Federer's first close call with Fire, I imagine Fire as a bounty hunter, and in his back pocket, a wanted poster. Federer, dead or alive. And I thought, you know, that would do.
Oh, well, that's excellent. I'm very... Somebody told me that you had tried to rhyme Federer with et cetera, and I was a little dubious about that.
I think tried is the wrong word there. I think I actually did.
Ah.
No, I confessed that to a journalist that I was working on a little sonnet that might try and get away with that. And actually, I think that little sonnet's working quite well. I'm probably going to put it up on the blog later and hope no one notices.
Well, I'm sure people will notice and they'll be delighted by it, as they are sure to be by everything that you're producing. But there are challenges in this tournament. What do you do if Elena Dementieva ends up winning?
I put her name in the middle of the line. And I repeat what I said at the very beginning of the tournament when I was first talking to people, saying, I'm really here to write about the grass and the strawberries and the umpires and the ball boys.
Of course, you could always go with Dementieva made a save too, didn't she?
Hey!
Do you get to name a successor because, well, check this out. His words are most lively, his syllables bounce right by other poets whom he'd likely trounce if they had the tennis balls to take his measure. His verse is a bloody delight and a pleasure. Thank you, Matt Harvey, championships poet, for speaking with
Well,
me.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Venus and Serena Williams own 8 Wimbledon women's single crowns between them. As Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, there's a sister act preparing to take the world of junior tennis by storm. Enter Tornado and Hurricane.
As Sly Black hits tennis balls to his 12-year-old daughter one recent spring morning on a public court in Bradenton, Florida, the two look like thousands of other parents and tennis-playing children.
Good. Wrist control. Good. Wait for the finish. Back.
But this is no ordinary family outing. For one thing, it's mid-morning on a school day. The Jamaican-born father once played for that country's Davis Cup team and coached at the high-powered Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And the willowy 5-foot-5-inch girl receiving his instruction and nailing her returns has a lofty, albeit soft-spoken, ambition.
I want to be number one in the world.
She has the daunting name of Tornado Alicia Black, Tornado Alley for short, which just might be where some of her recent opponents think they've ended up. Tornado swirled onto the junior tennis scene 14 months ago at the United States Tennis Association's National Spring Championships for girls 12 and under in Delray Beach, Florida. Her mother, Gail, says that the 10-year-old surprised even the tournament organizers.
We knew she was an excellent player, but we didn't know how she would rank up against the top 12-year-olds. And we decided just to take her, let her have a good time. We asked for a wild card, and they kind of gave us a hard time. Like, are we going to give this little 10-year-old girl a wild card? You know, other girls have been playing all these years. They deserve it. And they gave us a wild card. She went all the way and won the whole thing.
Tornado tore through a field of 128 mostly older competitors. In the finals, she flattened the top seed by a score of 6-1, 6-love. Those results impressed renowned junior tennis coach Rick Macy, who taught tennis prodigies Serena and Venus Williams, as well as Andy Roddick and Jennifer Capriati, in their early years. Macy has just taken on Tornado as a student.
It's not just winning it. You know, the fact that she really hadn't played that much, and you just walk off the street and win a national, it shows that mentally she's wired a little different, because a lot of the girls are older. They're, you know, maybe stronger. Obviously, they're more mature, but she could mentally hang in there and, you know, not let things bother her. And even though that's a far cry from Wimbledon, it does give you a snapshot that she can handle things. There's a uniqueness there.
Tornado certainly can handle herself at the net as she answers the rapid-fire shots from her dad with deftly placed returns that fall consistently out of reach just inside each opposing sideline.
There's not a lot of flaws in her game, so a lot of the dirty work has been done. And, you know, if she can stay injury-free and just get the experience, I think Tornado, she can go as far as she wants. I think she's one of the best prospects I've seen in the last 10 years.
Sly adds that his daughter certainly lives up to her name.
She's a silent destruction on the tennis court. She's fast. She loves to be aggressive. So, Tornado fits her perfect.
Tornado admits she still has plenty to learn. Last summer, as an 11-year-old, she faced an elite international field at the Coupe LeBlanc Cup for 12-and-unders in Quebec. She finished an impressive third, but she's as proud of one particular moment during the competition.
In Canada, I served and volleyed, and I won the set on set point. And I was really happy about it. And that was, like, the first time I ever served and volleyed in a match and won.
While Tornado is well on her competitive way, what's got some in the tennis world talking about the second coming of Venus and Serena is the potential track of Tornado's little sister, Hurricane Tyra Black. Hurricane, a lifelong fan of the Williams sisters, is 9 years old and well under 5 feet tall. But she makes up for any height disadvantage with blazing forehand and backhand shots from the baseline, brought neatly into the far court by a ferocious topspin. And she sizes up opponents in ways that belie her youth.
If they have something weak, I try and see it when they hit the ball. I look for, like, how much racket speed, and, like, I try and see where they're going to hit it and how they hit it.
So say I'm on the court, right, and you see my racket speed isn't that fast, right? What then do you do?
I would try and come up and approach and just hit it and try and hit a winner.
The Black sisters spent 2 years on scholarship at the nearby Bolitari Tennis Academy before their father began coaching them last year. His daily training regimen calls for 5 hours on the court, along with an hour each for fitness training and stretching. The sisters play each other frequently, and their sibling rivalry extends to debating which of their namesake storms is bigger and stronger. They're also being homeschooled by their mother, who's fond of saying that they were tennis players before they were born.
We take a lot of heat from people all over the world about how aggressive we are with the children and homeschooling them, but, you know, we believe school is very important. And their tennis is very important, and they've got the talent to be top in the world, and there's no reason not to push them all the way. You have to have a heavy hand as far as pushing them as a parent to get them where they need to be, or they'll never get there.
Gail Black adds that she and her husband are grooming Tornado for the World Junior Tennis Tour at age 13 and the professional WTA Tour by the time she reaches the minimum required age of 14. To that end, Sly is handing over the primary coaching duties of his daughters to Rick Macy and moving the family across the state, where Macy has his own tennis academy, a track record of turning out future pros, and a message about expecting too much too soon out of young talents.
That balance, you know, that balance that you need in life is key. It's not just 24/7, and some parents think it's a race to the finish line, and it's not. And that's where you got to be careful. Because it might not implode on you till down the road when the kid's old enough to drive a car or to get a boyfriend or girlfriend and they say, I'm out of here, game, set, match, I don't want to do it, and I see it all the time.
As to whether Tornado and Hurricane can eventually fill the tennis shoes of Venus and Serena, Macy says the answer is a long way off. In the next month, both of the youngsters will take up their studies in earnest at Macy's Academy in Boca Raton. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Shackett. And around and around. Yes, it's a tornado. Gonna touch the ground. It's a tornado. Gonna hit the town. Pretty ballerina, pretty ballet moves. Looks real pretty with her pretty ballet shoes. First she looks up, then she looks down. Then she looks up, and then she spins around and around.
You're listening to Only a Game. This week's email brought more suggestions for future stories. Among the subjects listeners think we should explore as soon as possible are yacht racing, the Hershey Bears minor league hockey team, minor league baseball, and various places, and my own current favorite candidate from Diane Gibbons, who listens to Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio. I would love to hear a piece about the terrific and sadly neglected sport of dog agility, she wrote. Dogs having fun, handlers having a great time. What could be better? Please cover my favorite sport soon. Lots of listeners wrote to inquire about the podcast of last week's program, which was not available due to computer-related problems far beyond my understanding. We'll try not to let that happen again, or someone will try not to let that happen again. Several people correctly caught my incorrect statement last week regarding the U.S. soccer team after their draw with Slovenia. I said their fate was no longer entirely in their own hands, but it was, as Matt Rush, who listens to the podcast in California, explained in verse. Advancing to the knockout stage is up to us. If we beat Algeria, there will be no fuss. Because England and Slovenia can't both win, we'll have 5 points, and that will put us in. And by golly, the U.S. did beat Algeria, albeit with very little time to waste. Among the listeners who enjoyed my story about the Honeywell Hill Climb last week was Roland Hine, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio. When you mentioned Ben Bragg and his wife, he wrote, I hoped you would go on about Ben Bragg's car, a wondrous device called the Old Gray Mare, a somewhat famous race car from the 30s, 40s, and early 50s, lovingly and faithfully restored. I wanted to catch up with Mr. Bragg, but on the hill that morning in Wellesley, he was just too fast. So the Old Gray Mare is all that she used to be. And finally, Dean Riley emailed as follows, Bill or Charlie, I have an ongoing debate with my husband that basketball is not as pleasing a game to watch now as it was 40 years ago. I know the athletes are better, but it's a matter of aesthetics. My husband says I'm way off base. Please, referee. I'm going to turn that responsibility over to you, all of you. Visit onlyagame.org and let us know what you think regarding this matter or any other, or leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also contact us through our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio, and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. Extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Former Red Sox pitcher Bill Lee once said that all anybody ever does in the bullpen is spit and laugh at stupid jokes. Jason Phillips, the bullpen catcher for the Seattle Mariners, would not agree. Last May, Phillips locked eyes with a woman in the stands at Safeco Field. She smiled, he smiled. If this game goes into extra innings, Phillips told his bullpen mates, I'm going to make a move. The game did go beyond 9 innings, and Phillips was true to his word. He wrote his phone number on a baseball and lobbed it to the woman, whose name is Molly Ray. On Sunday, she will become Mrs. Bullpen Catcher, and a ceremony will be conducted where else? In the Mariners' bullpen. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, 80 years worth of New Yorker sports writing as collected by editor David Remnick. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at the 17 stations of Georgia Public Broadcasting. These include Albany, Athens, Augusta, Carrollton, Chatsworth, Dahlonega, Demorest, Folkestone, Fort Gaines, Macon, Rome, Savannah, St. Mary's, Tifton, Valdosta, Warm Springs, and Waycross, baby! And we're everywhere!
Waycross is Waycross, Georgia.
It's way south, but okay.
The U.S. faces Ghana this afternoon in the second round of the World Cup. President Obama has already called to offer his congratulations to the team for making it to the knockout rounds. You want to join him?
No, because the way things are going for this guy, they're going to lose 12-0 today. But, no, I mean, I'd certainly have to congratulate the United States for making a knockout round that France and Italy, among others, couldn't make.
Here's a headline from that crack reporting team at USA Today. Quote, Italian fans disappointed at early World Cup exit. Gee, you think?
Well, considering that not far into the story, we get a quote from Dr. Rosalimo Fazzi, who happens to live in Scotland, by the way, which, where he says, "I want to scream! I am angry as I have come all this way, confident that my team would win the World Cup. I want to scream!"
The Washington Wizards selected John Wall with the first pick of the NBA draft on Thursday, and all five Kentucky players went in the first round, which is a record. I'm sure this will do wonders for Coach Calipari's legendary humility.
Well, I'm sure it will. It will also do marvelous things to his graduation rate, because I'm sure all five of these folks are going to come back and get their degrees in the offseason. it does lead to the question, how the heck did this team not win the NCAA championship last year? The Washington Wizards are in a bizarre position because they don't really need John Wall, but there's no real reason, a way they can avoid taking him.
All right, how's this for a complicated human resources problem? About an hour before the NBA draft, the Portland Trail Blazers fired general manager Kevin Pritchard, but Pritchard stayed on through the draft, and by all accounts, he resisted the urge to draft accounting majors and guys with two left feet. Do you think you could have done the same in his position?
I think you would have to, because you want another job in the NBA, and Kevin Pritchard's a heck of a general manager. He turned not only the record of that franchise around, but its reputation, which was pretty much the bottom of the NBA barrel. Why he was fired, I have absolutely no idea. I think it's going to go down as the worst off-season move any NBA team made this year. He will have a job, I suspect, before the next season starts.
Boston Celtics forward Rasheed Wallace reportedly will retire this summer. Would you like to offer some parting words to the NBA's all-time leader in technical fouls?
Ball don't lie. What can I say? It's Rasheed Wallace's philosophy. He fouls you, the ball doesn't go in. He says, ball don't lie. Goodbye, Sheed. You almost did what you came here for.
Last night, the brothers Upton met on the baseball field for the first time. BJ plays center field for Tampa Bay. Justin plays right field for Arizona. The family reportedly brought 70 members to cheer for one or both. I don't know. Do you think they ever figured out which team they should root for?
No, I don't think so. I think they all had a really good time at the ballpark. Yvonne, the mother of BJ and Justin, apparently was going to design a jersey that had both the Devil Rays and the Diamondbacks on it. Perhaps it was called the Diamond Rays or something, which actually sounds like a David Bowie album.
Devilbacks is scarier.
Devilbacks is much scarier.
Bobby Valentine will reportedly be the next manager of the Florida Marlins. He had been under consideration for the Orioles job, but withdrew his name when the Marlins position became available. So, will you be happy to see Mr. Valentine back in a Major League dugout?
I never had any real objection to him as a manager, although some baseball people think he's full of himself. And if baseball people think you're full of yourself, you're full of yourself. But I think he was pretty good with ESPN. He's got some young talent there. He's got to try to get into the head of Hanley Ramirez and figure out how to get the guy to play for the rest of the year. I wish him luck.
In what was quite possibly the quickest rule change in Major League sports history, NHL owners voted this week on strict penalties for blindside hits to the head. So a change that's come soon enough?
Well, the complete lack of anything that happened in the wake of what happened to Mark Savard of the Bruins has apparently sunk in. And the NHL has decided that anything that makes it look like a minor league, it should be eliminated. This is a good move.
The Hockey Hall of Fame has announced its first two female members. Charlie, Cammy Granato and Angela James will be inducted in November. So you want to offer a tip of your hockey helmet?
I do, because this is a really good thing for the Hockey Hall of Fame to do. I don't imagine, given the nature of the electorate, it was an easy thing to do. And these are two very fine candidates to be the first women picked.
Okay, quiz time. What caused the lovely Gigi Salmon, commentator for Wimbledon Radio, to utter the following this week?
Your lovely lady just offered me a drink, a non-alcoholic variety. She said, you've been here so long.
Shame.
Would you like a drink? But she doesn't know how badly I need the toilet.
I bet you can guess this one.
I believe it was the match between Nicolas Mahut and John Isner, the match that went to 70-68 in the fifth and entertained everybody over 3 days. And I feel so sorry for that woman. I truly do.
She's soldiered
Get
on.
Get her own loo, for God's
she's
sake.
She's soldiered on, by golly. Of course, after beating Nicolas Mahut in the longest game ever played, the American John Isner went on to lose the following day in the shortest match at Wimbledon so far. Gee, who could have seen that coming?
25 games. He lost 6-0, 6-3, 6-2 to Thiemo de Baker, who's a Dutchman, and this is absolutely no surprise to anyone, and you know they can bet on these matches, and anyone who didn't bet against Isner in the following match was out of his mind.
A Connecticut court is being asked to decide if cheerleading is a sport. Among the pros, cheerleaders train, they compete, they perform difficult and dangerous stunts. Among the cons, cheerleading is not recognized as a sport by the NCAA. So on which side of the pom-pom line do you come down?
Boy, this is a tough one because the effort to make cheerleading a sport is being done by a school looking for ways to meet gender equity requirements. This is one that's going to go all the way up the food chain in regards to Title IX requirements. I would almost guarantee it. I won't even pretend to play a federal judge on the radio. I think it's good to define the question. I'm just afraid how the question is going to be defined.
And finally, Charlie, when does a 528-pound blue marlin beat out an 883-pound blue marlin in a fishing tournament?
When the guy who caught the 883-pound winning marlin doesn't have a fishing license. Unfortunately, the bureaucracy has come down and said the mate aboard a boat named Citation did not have a coastal recreational license as required by law. The competitors reminded of this prior to the tournament, so they've got no excuse. But I do think we should all take note that the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, the organization that had to pass this particular judgment on the fishing tournament, is headed by a woman named Nancy Fish.
Charlie Sports, Charlie
hey!
Pierce, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
I want to scream!
Over the years, a great many fine stories have appeared in The New Yorker. The best of them having to do with our games have been collected in the only game in town, subtitled Sports Writing from The New Yorker, although most of it is not sports writing as that term is generally understood. Joining me now from NPR's New York Bureau is the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, who is also the editor of The Only Game in Town. David, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book is dedicated to Roger Angel, who's been writing about baseball for The New Yorker for many years. How did you go about picking one of his many New Yorker stories for inclusion in this collection?
Fear. Fear of Roger. Fear of picking wrong. You know, it's funny. When I was an intern, a summer intern at The Washington Post about 3.5 million years ago, I was told to go to an underground Italian restaurant on the edge of town where a man named Roger Angel would be coming through on book tour to do a TV appearance across the street, and I was to have lunch with him and do an interview with him and publish it in the paper if it was any good. I'd read him like crazy. He'd started writing for The New Yorker in the mid-60s about baseball, and this was probably already 1980 or something like that. And I have to admit that he was one of the most terrifying people I've ever met in my life. And I learned a very important lesson that day, is that the throne voice of a writer, and Roger's voice as a writer is one of this kind of jaunty man at his leisure, almost looking like the guy on the Monopoly set, twirling his cane as he goes to the ballpark. And here was this rather grim-faced guy at first, and I was very scared to meet him because I revered him. And then within 2 seconds, he had just come back from Fenway Park, and he started showing me all the angles in the outfield fence of Fenway. And he was using sugar packets and toothpicks and salt and pepper shakers, and he came alive, and he was absolutely seductively wonderful. And so a relationship began.
I was glad to see Bill Barich's story titled Racetrack in the book. When you reread that piece, did you find yourself wishing the author was still writing about horse racing instead of his more recent passion, which is cooking?
If I've learned anything in 12 years of editing The New Yorker, it's a mug's game to impose your wishes on a writer. And it's also a bad idea to want the writer to do what he or she was doing X years ago. It's like going to a certain kind of concert and wanting them to play I Want to Hold Your Hand all the time. What makes a writer exciting when the writer is still alive is the development and what's next. And an editor's job is to be wide open to that. So sure, you know, some writers stick with one subject all the way through and make it their lodestar, but many other writers jump from one thing to another. A.J. Liebling, who's another star of this anthology, and along with Roger, probably the great sports writers of the New Yorker historically, had a period when he loved going to the fights, but then he wanted to write about food, and then he wanted to write about France and the war, and he moved around. It's the nature of editors to follow and be liegemen to writers.
My favorite story in this collection is one that I had not read before, Legend of Sport by Alva Johnston, published in 1950. The story celebrates a character named Wilson Meisner, who was a manager of prize fighters who had various, even less reputable sidelines as well. He married...
Is there a less reputable
well,
one to
have? I'm going to say that, yes, according to this essay at least. Anyway, the guy married the widow of one Charles Yerkes, who left her $40 million. Would you read for us the passage about how Mr. Meisner dealt one day with a noisy clock in the Fifth Avenue mansion he inhabited with his wife?
Sure, and $40 million in those days was real money. The cream of the fun for Meisner was showing the room to friends with hangovers and seeing their nervous systems murdered when all the clocks let go at once. Meisner told McArdle that his first serious domestic strife arose over the clock situation. He came home sober one morning, went to bed a little after 3 a.m. and was roused at 4 by the shrieking of a cuckoo clock in his own room. He had ordered his servants to make every clock run, and they had taken him literally. He got up, cursing, and found the clock high up on the wall and out of reach. He went to the Yerkes arsenal on the fourth floor, returned to his room, and went to bed again. When the cuckoo screamed at 5 a.m., he lit the lights and gave it both barrels of one of the Yerkes shotguns. That, according to McArdle, started the bride wondering whether her new consort had the true Fifth Avenue spirit. You know, as a reader, for me, when you read a sentence like, the cream of the fun for Meisner was showing the rooms to friends with hangovers and seeing their nervous systems murdered when all the clocks let go at once, it's the use of the word murdered that is what separates the real ones from the not-so-real.
One of the most powerful stories in the book, at least for me, is a piece Adam Gopnik wrote in 2004. Could that article about American art historian Kirk Varnado have as easily been characterized as an art story?
You know, I don't know. And honestly, the fact that it's about sports or art is incidental. What it's obviously about is friendship and fathers and sons. What it's about is a very famous curator in New York who had done big shows on Picasso and Matisse, Kirk Varnado, who was a friend of Adam's. Adam's also an art critic, and he wears many hats for the magazine, and who coached Adam's kids' football team while he was dying. It was very evident that Kirk Varnado was not going to live much longer, and yet his enthusiasm for the game of football, which he played in college, I think at Williams, if I remember right, was electrifying and a life force for him. And finally, if sports writing is any good and it's more than just yesterday's game or sentimental profile that we forget 2 days later, if it's something more than that, it's something more than balls and bats and goalposts. And I think that piece more than qualified.
It is, as you suggest, it's a story about fathers and sons and an older man and teaching a game to younger boys. But it's also a story about being alive for as long as you're alive, never giving in to the intimation of one's own immortality.
Precisely. And one of the great memories that they share and that they talk about was that tremendous pass.
The Hail Mary pass that Flutie threw.
Exactly. Doug Flutie's great pass. I mean, there's these kind of magical moments that sports fans, even the casual fan, marks their lives sometimes by.
Have you a favorite story in The Only Game in Town?
you're treading on them.
Well, I know Roger Angel is listening, so I'm pretty sure I know what your answer is.
Then it is absolutely Roger's piece. look, the book is dedicated to Roger. Roger's going to be, God help us all, 90 in the fall. He's in the office every day. He writes, he kibitzes, he edits. He's a big presence at the magazine to this day. And I very much wanted to do this book, not least to expand the range of New Yorker anthologies to this seemingly unlikely subject. But to me, Roger Angel is the writer who devoted himself to a sport who is the greatest at it. Some may argue, who are newspaper inclined, that Red Smith was that person. Some may be fans more of A.J. Liebling's but briefer career as a boxing writer. But I think that the collected work of Roger Angel, beginning with a book called The Summer Game, which was in the mid-60s, right through this very moment, is a real achievement of writing, American writing, and a really wonderful American writer that's very important to the magazine.
David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker magazine and also the editor of The Only Game in Town, sports writing from The New Yorker, published by Random House. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was fun. Thanks.
If you want to pitch a ball and you can't afford a hall, all you got to call is Lemmy of Uptown.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Radio Wimbledon broadcaster Gigi Salmon, who, despite the urgings of her broadcast partner, refused to leave the microphone after about 6 hours of Wednesday's Wimbledon marathon between Nicola Mahou and John Isner.
You know, the queue for the toilet's going to be massive.
Run.
Massive. Huge.
Find your own private toilet. You deserve one.
Huge.
After that. With your own key.
Oh,
Gigi,
wow.
Salmon.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Come on and let me off.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. LendingTree, with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.